With colder temperatures hanging around, it may not feel like it, but spring is here. Monday is opening day for the Milwaukee Brewers, and we've got the primary election on Tuesday. We'll have more on both of those subjects in today's Behind the Headlines from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for listening. All right, we're going to jump right into some political coverage to start the show. Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert has been in town lately for what are obvious reasons. Reporter Tom Dakin caught up with Craig. The two discussed the complicated and differing ways that Wisconsin's Republican and Democratic presidential primaries divvy up delegates among the candidates and how that affects the campaigns.
Craig Gilbert, hi. Welcome to our weekly podcast. I'm Tom Dakin, a fellow reporter here at the Journal Sentinel, and we're here to talk today about a story that is right now running in JS Online about how the rules are different for both for Democrats and Republicans in terms of how votes, or I should say how delegates, are allotted in this coming Tuesday's primary. Tell me a little bit about the difference between the two parties.
So this is a confusing process for a lot of reporters, a lot of voters, and even for some candidates because the rules differ from state to state and they differ from party to party. In Wisconsin, the Democrats and the Republicans both award the majority of their delegates on the basis of who wins the state's 8 congressional districts. Most of the rest of them are awarded to the statewide winner, but they use two different systems for allocating those delegates. The Republicans have a more straightforward and easy-to-understand system. Basically, if you win statewide, you get all of those statewide delegates, and for every congressional district you win, you get 3 delegates for that congressional district, and that's 3 × 8 = 24, and that's the majority of the state's 42 convention delegates. The Democrats, it's a little bit different. For one thing, they do assign a majority of their delegates at the congressional district level and most of the rest of them at the statewide level. But they don't treat all their congressional districts the same. They give extra delegates to districts like Milwaukee's 4th congressional district and Madison's 2nd congressional district because there are more Democratic voters in those districts. And fewer delegates to districts like the 5th congressional district, which is the most Republican district in the state and is in southeastern Wisconsin. They also award those delegates proportionally, not on a winner-take-all basis. And so whatever percentage you win in the statewide vote, you get a proportional share of those statewide delegates. And even within the congressional districts, if you win 60% of the 4th congressional district, which has 10 delegates, you get 6 delegates and your opponent gets 4, and you only gain an advantage of 2 delegates. So the implications of this system are really interesting in both parties.
How's this going to affect then these final few days of campaigning up until Tuesday's primaries for both the Republican candidates and for those on the
right.
Democrat side?
Well, in two ways. It means that it does matter where your regional support is. Even if you lose the state, you can win delegates if you're strong in one part of the state. And we saw that, for example, in 2012 in the Republican primary when Mitt Romney won statewide. But Rick Santorum did really well in the North and the West. He won 3 congressional districts and still came away with 9 delegates. So it means that candidates are playing to their regional strengths. You're seeing Donald Trump campaign across the North in the next few days. You've seen Bernie Sanders go to Madison a lot where he's really strong. But it has very different implications when you consider the dynamics of the two races. In the Republican race, Donald Trump's opponents are trying to deny him any delegates because they don't want him to get to a majority before the convention. They want a contested convention. And Wisconsin rules make it possible to do that. If Ted Cruz can win statewide, he'll get the lion's share of delegates. And if they can prevent Donald Trump from winning any congressional districts, he'll get 0 delegates. On the Democratic side, it's not so great for the candidate chasing the front runner, which is Bernie Sanders,
right,
because he has to make up a big delegate lead on the part of Hillary Clinton. And no matter how well he does, it's going to be hard to make big delegate gains because everything is proportional. She's going to win you know, more than 40% of the delegates under almost any scenario, whether she wins the state or loses the state by 5 or 10 points to Bernie Sanders.
And finally, is there any specific reasons we can look at as to why the Democrats chose to do their allocation formula one way and the Republicans chose to do it a different way?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, the one thing that has always been true is that the two parties do it their own way. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's true is we have this remarkable hodgepodge in America where these rules change from state to state. And we've seen this sort of interesting back and forth on the Republican side between Donald Trump and the RNC, which is chaired by Wisconsin's Reince Priebus. And Donald Trump is scratching his head and complaining when he wins a state and he doesn't get the share of delegates he expects to get. And he's learning the vagaries and intricacies of this system, which is very odd. And it's odd the fact that, you know, one set of rules in Louisiana and one set of rules in Wisconsin. It's odd that the parties have different sets of rules. And part of running a presidential campaign, obviously, is mastering these sometimes really, really Byzantine rules that are really coming into play, particularly on the Republican side this cycle, because of the potential for a contested convention.
Well, thanks, Greg. Look forward to reading the story. And by the way, thanks for using the word Byzantine. It was in my mind the entire time you worked it in. Good job, man. Thanks.
Excellent.
For more from Craig, visit jsonline.com/politics. You can download our JS on Politics podcast from iTunes and Stitcher Radio as well. And we'll have more primary election coverage coming up later in the show. Keep listening for more. As I said earlier, Monday is opening day for the Brewers. And new names in the lineup won't be the only thing new at Miller Park this season. Editor Chris Foran has a scouting report on some of the new attractions and foods Brewers fans should look for this season. He talks with Allison Sherwood about that, as well as his annual look at baseball-related books.
Not only is spring the start of baseball season, but it's also baseball book season. Chris, each year you write about the new lineup of baseball books hitting shelves. When and how did you start doing this, and how many baseball books do you think you've read over the years?
Well, we started doing these baseball book roundups in 2010, so this would be year 7. As far as how many baseball books I've read over the years, for this project, probably around 100, maybe 120, but I've been reading them since I was a little kid.
And how do you choose which books to include each year?
Well, first we look at things that have obvious local interests. If there's things about the Brewers or the Braves or things that touch on the baseball experience in Milwaukee, that's important to keep in mind. Look at subjects that have not been written about a lot, or books that take a different attack or approach to a topic that's been written about a lot.
So what types of books can we find in this new crop of baseball books that you wrote about?
Among the nonfiction books that we looked at this year is a book that fits that category of people taking a new approach to something that gets written about endlessly. It's a book called The Selling of the Babe, The Deal That Changed Baseball and Created a Legend. Baseball fans and historians love to debate the issue of Babe Ruth and him being when he was a young player, sold from the Boston Red Sox to the New York Yankees, which changed the game. Glenn Stout, in his new book, looks at it from kind of a different angle, and that it did change everything, but not in the ways that people thought. And for example, the fact that the Red Sox were not doing that well with Babe Ruth, even though they won a couple of World Series. He was kind of a disruptive influence. The celebrity that he got for hitting home runs came at the expense of his being a really good pitcher. He was one of the game's best pitchers at the time, too. And she showed, using modern statistical methods, that he actually lost more games for them than as a batter than he won as a pitcher. On the fiction front, we look at a mystery writer named T.T. Monday. This year came out with his second book. They're thrillers based with the central character as a relief pitcher who is a private detective on the side. The new book is called Double Switch, and he does a really good job of your classic noir-style detective fiction. But he also does a really good job of putting you into the head of a player, a veteran player, especially in the game and why you still play and how that works. And it's fun for a baseball fan, but it's also good if you just like mysteries. Another book that's on that list is a book by actor David Duchovny, who's just started writing fiction a couple years ago, and his second novel is called Bucky Effing Dent. It's about set in 1978, and it's about a writer's block writer who bonds with his estranged father over his father's love of the Boston Red Sox during the 1978 season, where the Red Sox battled the Yankees for the pennant. When he discovers that his father gets sicker when the Yankees win and gets healthier when the Red Sox win, he sort of gins it up by feeding his father fake newspaper articles and taping baseball games and showing him when the Red Sox win. It's more of a story about fathers and sons, which is what a lot of baseball fiction ends up being about, fathers and sons.
And is there a zombie book in there, too?
There is. There's a book called The House of Daniel, written by a guy named Harry Turtledove. House of Daniel is about a journeyman semi-pro baseball player who, while he's on the run in 1930s, is on the run. He joins a team that plays for a religious commune actually based in Wisconsin in the story. And the wrinkle in Harry Turtledove's book is that the America they're playing in is not only hit by a depression but has zombies and werewolves and vampires. And a lot of it's entertaining, but it's kind of silly. And the baseball part is actually more interesting.
And another book that sticks out for a different reason is called Baseball and the Law. It's more than 1,000 pages long, and it's aimed at legal scholars. But why might Milwaukeeans find this book interesting?
Well, I wouldn't exactly think this is something you pick up for your coffee table. But Baseball and the Law, it was interesting to me and to us because Milwaukee has a big role in a lot of baseball history, and a lot of, including the stuff that ends up in court. And among the cases that this really long book focuses on are two major cases that had an impact on the baseball we see today. One of them is the lawsuit in Wisconsin trying to stop the Braves from moving from Milwaukee to Atlanta, which in the end was unsuccessful. And another is a lawsuit that involved a player at the old minor league Brewers team who was transferred kind of on the sly from one minor league team to another, and the commissioner of baseball at the time tried to put a stop to it. The ruling that resulted confirmed that the commissioner of baseball has this kind of all-knowing power. He's probably one of the most powerful figures in the country in terms of what he can do and not be stopped by courts. So it's kind of interesting. It is a little dense, though, for an average reader.
All right. Switching gears, you've got another baseball-related story in the paper this weekend. This story is for those of us who go to baseball games more for the off-the-field entertainment. I know you are not one of those people. You go for the baseball. But what can you tell us about some new attractions at Miller Park this year?
Well, I think this is going to be the kind of season where you're going to be looking for off-the-field entertainment. Every year they do, you know, they spruce up Miller Park with new additions and new stuff to do. But there's a lot of new activities in the kids' areas. To me, the stuff that's really interesting is there's a lot of new food, real Wisconsin-themed stuff, like the Wisconsin Dog, which has got house-made beer jam, glazed sauerkraut, and chopped bacon, of course. The one that kind of caught me by surprise was the banh mi brat, which is basically a brat with Asian slaw on a banh mi bun. Every year they try to expand what they offer, and it's also a lot more free stuff this year. Kids 14 and younger get to eat free on Sundays, which is pretty awesome. And I guess it isn't in the field, but out in the tailgate country, and I guess in some neighborhoods, Brewers are starting this year. They have an ice cream treat truck where they'll be giving out free ice cream. And they have the usual pile of giveaway things, my personal favorite being the talking euchre alarm clock, which says, get up, get up, get out of bed, apparently.
Read about more new foods at Miller Park and Chris's full list of baseball books at tapmilwaukee.com. We'll hear from Brewers beat writer Todd Rosiak in today's show, so stay tuned for more. A Milwaukee entrepreneur wants to help men look a little more put together and help them do less ironing. He's invented something that helps men's button-down shirts stay crisp around the collar. Business reporter Rick Rimmel spoke with Gina Barton about the invention.
In our business section this week, reporter Rick Rimmel brings us the story of the million-dollar collar. But even though its inventor is the son of a prominent Milwaukee jeweler, it's not an expensive necklace. Rick, tell us about this invention.
Well, the inventor we're talking about is Rob Kessler, and he's the son of Richard Kessler, who anyone who has listened to radio commercials in Milwaukee will know as the owner of Kessler's Diamonds, a very successful local jewelry chain. Rob had a clothing business going in Milwaukee for several years, but he decided to branch out into this million-dollar collar enterprise after he became frustrated with the upper part of his shirts sort of flopping down because of the weight of the collar.
And how did Rob come up with this idea?
Well, he's kind of an open collar kind of guy, very, you know, stylish, but not not real formal. And even at his wedding, he wore an open collar shirt under his sport coat. And he said he was looking at the wedding pictures later and saw how his shirt was sort of sagging and drooping at the top and thought, that's it. I've got to do something about this. So he started working on ways to stiffen the upper part of the shirt. And even though he calls it the million-dollar collar, it really is a device that stiffens what's called the placket of the shirt. Now, of course, everyone knows what a placket is, right?
Oh, sure, yes.
Yeah, right. The placket is that band of folded-over cloth, double-layer cloth that runs down the middle of a man's dress shirt, and some women's shirts as well. And it's kind of the center of the shirt. But in what Rob came up with is a couple of little plastic stays, they're called, strips of plastic that are inserted inside of the between the layers of the placket, one on either side of the shirt, the button side and the buttonhole side. And they hold they kind of firm up the shirt and give it some structure so that when you open the top button or two, if you're a daring man like Rob, of the shirt, the collar will stay sort of upright and firm.
And not kind of wrinkly and messy looking?
It doesn't flop over, and it really does. It's not a good look. He has a picture on his website of himself at his wedding, which I think was in Jamaica. And as I said, he has this open collar shirt and a sport coat on and a flower tucked inside his jacket pocket. And the photo has him sort of looking down, and he looks like a candidate who's been rejected on The Bachelor.
So even though he's not famous himself per se, it looks like he's got some celebrities who have bought into this invention of his.
Well, yes, and that's part of his strategy as to develop this business, which I must say is very small and very right at the beginning stage. It's a one-man operation. It's him. He's shipped maybe like 3,500 of these the million-dollar collar, the placket stays, in roughly 3 months of doing business. He got his patent issued in December on the device. So one thing he's been trying to do is to sort of sell celebrities on this item so that they'll be like walking advertisements for it. And so far he's got two. Jeremy Piven.
From Entourage. Ari the Agent.
Yes, that's right, exactly. And he's Mr. Selfridge as well on a PBS series. And Justin Baldoni of Jane the Virgin.
Okay, I don't watch that one.
Yeah, I don't either. But both of these guys have worn them and apparently think well of them.
And how much do these cost, and how do you actually get them into the shirt?
The cost is minimal. Getting them into the shirt is an issue, and it's really a business issue for him, which he acknowledges. They're $2 to $3 a piece. You buy a pack of 10, it costs $25, so that's $2.50. And the issue is putting them into the shirt, which means you have to rip open the top of the shirt at the collar band, sort of the top of the placket, if I may be so specific, insert one stay on each side of the shirt, the button side and the buttonhole side, and then sew the shirt back up. Now, someone who's skilled with a sewing machine could do this themselves. Most guys probably are not going to be doing this. So you go to a tailor, you go to a dry cleaner that does alterations. They'll do it for you. Kessler says it's a very simple operation for a professional. Costs about $10. So the cost isn't extensive, but it's that extra step and the idea that you buy a nice dress shirt that you really like, and now you're going to be ripping it apart.
Right.
That's an issue.
Read more in Sunday's business pages and online at jsonline.com/business. Primary election season has sent politicians to Wisconsin the past few weeks. How does our editorial board handle this, especially when it comes to endorsements or recommendations? Editors Ernie Franzen and David Haynes talked about the board's evolving policy on endorsements and how it's played out in this election cycle.
Hi, this is Ernie Franzen of the Journal Sentinel editorial page. I'm here with editorial page editor David Haynes, and we want to talk to you about endorsements. 4 years ago, Dave wrote a column and saying we weren't going to do very many endorsements, and we haven't done any since then. This week, we've done a whole bunch. Dave, how do we change our mind?
Well, yeah, in 2012, I decided along with other members of the board that we wanted to scale back recommendations. And the reason for that was I felt at the time, and I still believe, that if we're going to remain independent, both politically, which we are, and in terms of being an honest broker of opinion, running our forum both in print and online and on our mobile devices, that doing recommendations in political races just wasn't the best thing to do. But we always left ourselves the opening to come back and do them if we thought there was, for some reason, an unusual race. And I think by all accounts, the Republican race this year qualifies as unusual. So we made a decision to make a recommendation there. We first took Donald Trump to the woodshed, frankly, for being Donald Trump.
Yeah, let me ask you about why do two different editorials? Why do one just slamming Trump and the other one endorsing Kasich, which we did this week?
Yeah. We felt as a board that Trump simply isn't fit to be president. He's a fine reality TV show star, but he has not thought about the issues beyond what Michael Gerson of the Washington Post referred to as more than a micron deep. And that's just clear. And he's divided people. This idea of walling out Muslims, all Muslims, a religious test in the land of the free is just absurd. And walling off immigrants from coming into the country, or shipping 11 million people who are here undocumented back to wherever they came from. It's just, you know, crazy ideas that we have to take him at his word. So we thought it was important to take a stand against Trump. But we also thought we wanted to be proactive and positive and say, you know, there is one candidate in the race, and it's not Ted Cruz. It's John Kasich, who is a conservative for conservatives who are looking for a conservative Republican. He's conservative by any measure. But he's also, and this impressed us, he's also independent-minded. He's been willing to work with the other side. After he lost a union fight in Ohio around the same time Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin was taking on the public employee unions in Wisconsin, Kasich lost that fight, and he found a way to work with unions after that. In fact, has some union support now in Ohio.
Great. What about – we also endorsed in the Supreme Court race and in the mayor's race and the county execs race. Those were more conventional kind of races. What drove the endorsements in those cases?
Well, if you look at those three, I would say that let's take them one at a time. In the state Supreme Court race, what we're essentially saying is we have concerns about both candidates, but we've come to believe that Rebecca Bradley clearly just isn't ready for that job. And so it was more a case of being less enthralled with John Kloppenberg and more just really concerned about Bradley and where she would take that court. On the mayor's race, again, it was Bob Donovan simply he has no business being mayor. We have some concerns with Mayor Barrett. We think in many ways he's done a good job, but we still have concerns about his leadership, and we express those. So that was less of a recommendation and more of a we simply don't like one of the candidates. On county executive, that's a very close race, and we feel that Abley has earned our support. We also are concerned about Senator Larson. I think he's a fine politician. I think he means well, but we think he would take that the county board or the county, Milwaukee County, in a direction that we don't think it should go. And we think Abley basically has done a decent job.
Now, moving forward, are we going to see more endorsements in the fall?
You know, it's hard to say. I still think our default position needs to be that we basically don't do recommendations, but there will be times when it's going to be important for us to step forward and have a say. So I guess we'll have to wait and see.
For more from our editorial team, pick up today's Crossroads section in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You'll also find video interviews with presidential candidates John Kasich and Bernie Sanders online at jsonline.com/opinion. what can Brewers fans realistically expect from this season? As a Cubs fan, I'm used to asking myself that question. But in Milwaukee, the concept of a rebuilding season could make things a little ugly. Brewers beat writer Todd Rosiak gave me the lowdown on the team before opening day.
The Brewers are hoping to nail down their roster by opening day. Can you tell me a little bit about what we're looking at?
I would probably work backward because the majority of the roster has been determined already. There's two spots going into opening day that are available at this point, one in the bullpen and one in the outfield. In the bullpen, you've got two guys battling for that one spot, Ariel Pena and Tyler Cravey. Two names that should be familiar to Brewers fans. They both pitched on the big league team last season. Pena's coming off a pretty good three-inning spot start for the Brewers a couple days ago in the Cactus League finale. And Cravey had been making some appearances as well. Either one of these guys, could factor in. The question becomes, as far as fit goes, Pena does not have any options remaining. Cravey does. So if the Brewers were to try to send Pena out and keep Cravey, that means they'd have to expose Pena to waivers and another team could pick him up. So based on that, my guess would be Pena making the bullpen over Cravey at this point. They could send Cravey down, then bring him back as needed later on in the season. The other spot that's open is there's two outfield spots open. Three guys competing for those spots: Kirk Neuenhuis, Keon Broxton, and Alex Presley. Neuenhuis closed camp strongly. I would think that he'll be on the team. Broxton started quickly. It's kind of petered out lately, but is the best defensive player out of those three. I would think he's probably a good bet to be on the roster, which would leave Presley out of the mix. He is not on the 40-man roster, which works against him. But interestingly, he probably had the best camp out of all three of those guys. So it's kind of a numbers crunch for him. I would expect him to not make the cut there, be sent down to AAA. The one thing that you can't discount is the Brewers could very well decide to go out and make an external move, either a minor trade or pick somebody else up from another team that was released. And if that's the case, then all bets are off at this point. But as things stand right now, heading into that final exhibition game in Biloxi on Saturday, those are the two spots, or the two areas, I should say, that are still kind of up in the air.
And when it comes to the roster, how important is the reliever position now that Will Smith injured his leg?
It becomes a question because Will Smith was unquestionably their best reliever, and he was expected to close games at least part of the time along with Jeremy Jeffress. And with him out of the mix now for quite some time with that freak knee injury, that leaves the job to Jeremy Jeffress. He's a guy that pitched late in games for the Brewers last season, so he's not a stranger to pressure situations. The question becomes, who backs him up at this point? I would expect him to be the primary closer, but without Will Smith in the mix, the Brewers are going to have to rely on some other guys who aren't quite as experienced. The two names that come immediately to mind would be Michael Blazek and Corey Knebel. Those are two guys that pitched last year for the Brewers as well and pitched pretty well for the Brewers. Two power arms and two guys who would seem to fit into the back end of the bullpen pretty well because of the fact that they can throw hard, but they just don't have that experience factor. So that remains to be seen how they react regularly in those late situations. But the Brewers do have some options. Beyond those guys, that the bullpen has been relatively hard hit here in the spring as far as injuries go. Will Smith is not the only guy who's out. Jonathan Barrios is out for quite some time. Sean Nolan is out for quite some time. So it's a position where the Brewers have options, but some of those guys have been knocked out with the injuries. So it's going to be interesting to see how things kind of shake out here as the days and weeks and months come forward.
All right, and I suppose now it's time to ask the most important question. What are your expectations for the seasons, and what should fans expect as well?
Expectations, I would say realistically, you're probably going to be looking at a team that's going to have a record similar to last year, if not a little bit worse, depending on what types of moves the Brewers make. Do they trade Jonathan Lucroy? Do they trade Ryan Braun? Do they trade, you know, any of their other established major leaguers? If that's the case and those trades happen relatively early, then all bets are off. But I think most people are expecting, you know, right around 100 losses. And, you know, truth be told, in a rebuild, which everybody understands this is, that just comes with the territory. It's in the short term, it's not pleasant to have to watch those kinds of games day after day with when you're not able to compete with the best teams in the division. But the thinking of it, I think everybody understands, which is the Brewers are trying to put together a team that can compete over the long haul consistently. So you live with the short-term pain for the long-term gain.
Pick up today's Journal Sentinel for more opening day coverage. Of course, you can also find that on jsonline.com as well. And on that note, I'll wrap up today's show. Kind of want to stop it before I make any bad baseball-related puns. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to join us next week as we bring you more insight from behind the headlines in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.